This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Dear Bob and Sue by Matt and Karen Smith. Narrated by David Colacci and Susan Erickson. Preface. We don't remember the moment or even the day we decided to visit all 58 national parks, but it called us just the same. We had spent the previous 28 years working and raising kids. Once they were grown and out of the house, we no longer needed to be home for them. It was time to take a break. The deciding factor may have been that we'd seen friends and family members, our age and younger, die before they did all the things they wanted to do. So in the spring of 2010, during the worst economy in our lifetime, with no guarantee we would find employment when we finished, we quit our jobs and began the journey. Our interest in the national parks came from our dear friends Bob and Sue. Their passion for the parks began before we met them. From the time their kids were babies, they spent most of their vacations visiting the parks. Their stories inspired us. We wish they had joined us on this adventure, but since they didn't, we sent them updates on our progress with occasional emails, texts, phone calls, and a couple of in-person visits. In the fall of 2010, we began writing about our trip, but struggled with the tone and format for the book. It was then that I sent the letter from the Ahwahnee Hotel, dated September 14, 2010, to Bob and Sue, along with gifts from our hotel room. I said to Karen, "I wish that writing the book was as easy as writing to Bob and Sue." That's when the idea came to us. We would write about our trip as a series of letters to Bob and Sue. Later, we changed the format to emails. If we were 20 or 30 years younger, we would have written this book as a series of text messages. In the interest of full disclosure, we didn't send all these emails to Bob and Sue on the dates indicated. But they are real people, their names really are Bob and Sue, and the events we've written about actually happened. This is not a guide to the national parks. It's a series of snapshots and impressions based on our experience. We didn't have time to see everything we wanted to see in every park, and we know we missed a lot of great stuff. We didn't camp, rock climb, scuba dive, or snorkel, but we did what we love. We hiked, drank beer, and had the time of our lives. We hope you enjoy listening to it and are inspired to create your own memories in the national parks. Matt and Karen Smith, 2012. From Matt Smith. Subject: Mouse on Head. Date: April 16, 2010. Dear Bob and Sue, planning our parks trip is harder than I thought it would be. Karen refuses to stay any place where there's a possibility she'll wake up in the middle of the night with a mouse on her head. She read a review for a motel in Utah where a woman described waking up to see a mouse on her husband's head. Now, before I book any room, Karen wants to check the online reviews. On top of the other logistical challenges with planning a 58-park trip, I also have to wait for her to give me the all-clear before I can book a room. It's surprising how many mouse complaints there are online. A lodge in one of the national parks had several mouse mentions in their reviews. The manager posted a response in the lodge's defense. He made the point that the lodge is a national park where there's a greater chance that animals would be in or around the property. And all the animals in the park are protected, including mice, so the lodge is limited in what they can do to prevent them from being in the rooms. The park service doesn't allow them to kill the mice. I said to Karen, "Why are you making such a big deal about this? I'm sure there have been times when mice were in our hotel room at night, maybe even running across our bodies, and you didn't know it." This, I'll admit, was a poor choice of words. She pulled her shoulders close to her ears and shivered as if she'd stuck her tongue in a light socket. I tried a different approach. "Karen, sweetie, you'll have to get used to roughing it a little. There might be rodents in our future." I can't wait to see what she does when we see our first tarantula. Your friend, Matt. Note to listener. There's something you should know about Karen. She's not a fan of rodents. She didn't like them before, but after her close encounter with a squirrel a few years ago, she wants nothing to do with them. One spring day I was away on a business trip. Karen was home with the kids. It was a warm afternoon, and she was sitting with our son Matthew at the computer in my office. The kitchen door that leads to the backyard was open. They were reviewing a homework project when they heard what sounded like fingernails scratching on the hardwood floors in the kitchen, followed by a thumping gallop from our cat's socks. An instant later, a squirrel raced into the office with the cat at its heels. In a panic, Karen grabbed Matthew and the cat and ran out of the office, slamming the door behind her. Her plan was to leave the squirrel in my office and let me deal with it when I got home in a few days. The homework could wait. However, 30 minutes and 2 glasses of Merlot later, Karen saw the flaw in her plan. She wasn't worried so much about sticking me with the task of removing a hungry, pissed-off squirrel from my office as she was the possibility of the squirrel shredding everything in there before I got home. Or worse, she feared the house would permanently smell of dead squirrel. There was a decent chance her scream had given it a heart attack. Luckily, the window in my office was open that afternoon. The only problem, there was a screen in the window. Karen figured if she could remove the screen, the squirrel, if it were still alive, would find its way back to the great outdoors. My office was on the first floor, so she was able to remove the screen easily from the outside. Standing in the backyard at a safe distance, she watched the open window, but no squirrel appeared. Venetian blinds were down, covering the window opening. Karen thought, if I just reach in and pull the cord on the blinds, I can raise them enough for the little rodent to see his escape route. Taking deep breaths while standing on the third rung of our stepladder, Karen thought through exactly what she had to do. Raise the blinds with one hand, pull the cord with the other, lock it in place, and get the hell out of there. No problem. The squirrel was no doubt cowering in the corner. Not quite. As soon as she raised the blinds, the squirrel, according to Karen, who was the only witness, saw daylight and flew through the air, landing on her head. Its toes were caught in Karen's hair as it made a desperate attempt to free itself. Karen said, "It was running in place on top of my head." She fell off the ladder and ran screaming through the backyard, with the squirrel stuck to her head. I'm sure it was only a few seconds, but time stands still when there's a squirrel on your head. It eventually freed its claws, jumped off her head, and ran away. Sue was the first person Karen called after she calmed down enough to speak. They discussed the situation thoroughly and agreed that shampooing several times with Head and Shoulders, rubbing the tiny scratch marks on her scalp with alcohol, and drinking the rest of the bottle of Merlot were the proper steps to prevent rabies. I was her second call. Karen gave me a second-by-second recounting of the event, complete with sound effects and a graphic description of how the squirrel's toes felt as they dug into her scalp. Then she told me the whole thing was my fault because I wasn't home to protect the family when it happened. Apparently, being away earning a living was not an acceptable excuse. She also said she learned a valuable lesson that day. Not to leave the back door open, I guessed. No, the lesson was that all squirrels are evil and out to get her. She also decided that she doesn't like any animal related to squirrels, whatever that means. From Matt Smith. Subject, O.C. without the D. Date, April 30th, 2010. Dear Bob and Sue, we're getting ready for our parks trip, so I made a list of things I need to carry in my backpack. I like being prepared. Karen thinks I overprepare. She calls this my OCD. I correct her every time, telling her, I'm OC without the D. I do not have a disorder. Karen shouldn't complain. She benefits from my OC. When we're traveling and need a flashlight, I have one. When we need a bottle opener, I have two. I carry two in case I lose one. I hid a third in Karen's backpack just in case I lose both of mine. There's no D, and I wish you would stop saying it. Today, Karen saw the list on our dresser. I was trying to keep her from seeing it because she makes fun of my lists. With a straight face, she started to ask me a question about it, but before the question came out, she looked like she was going to cry and covered her face with her hands. She laughed so hard she couldn't speak and walked out of the room. 10 minutes later, she came back. As soon as she saw me, crying face, hands up, walked out of the room. Why is this funny? We're going into the wilderness and need to be prepared. If I don't have a list, I'll forget something, and then what? What if we need duct tape and don't have any? What would we do? Probably not survive, that's what. If she thinks I'm going to share my stuff with her when we're out in the wild, she's mistaken. Maybe if I need her body warmth, I'll barter. I want to travel light, so I'm keeping my list to the bare minimum. Snacks, emergency space blanket, Ziploc bags, analog compass, sunglasses, binoculars, postcard stamps, sunscreen, chapstick with SPF 15 or higher, bug spray, Purell, bottle opener, Advil, liquid bandage, dental floss, finger and or toenail clippers, reading glasses, peppermint patties, extra house keys, 30-foot section of nylon cord. I don't know why I need this, but it's on all the lists of things to have in case of an emergency. Medical tape, wet wipes, extra flashlight batteries, napkins, water, snacks, GPS, extra batteries for the GPS, scissors, tweezers, tick remover, small roll of duct tape, Imodium AD, small tripod, camera, backup bottle opener, knife, fire starter, bear spray, spork, combination spoon, knife, fork, blister patch, snacks, gauze, earplugs, Dramamine, and micropuff vest. All that's in Karen's backpack is 3 wadded-up Kleenex, 4.5 candy corn, the bottle opener I hid there, 2 Corona Light bottle caps, and a tampon. It's all a big joke until she needs something and doesn't have it. Then my OC isn't that funny. She better hope she doesn't need my Imodium AD on our flight to American Samoa. I'm not sure I'll have any to spare. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject, Our National Parks Passport. Date, May 10th, 2010. Dear Bob and Sue, it's a memorable moment when your spouse says, you were right and I was wrong. I'm only guessing, of course, because Karen has never said this. I found her today admiring her National Parks passport, the little blue book you introduced to us years ago. At first, Karen laughed at the idea of a National Parks passport, but now she's proud of hers. She can't wait to get a stamp from every national park. I bought my passport in April 2006 at Grand Canyon National Park. When I was in the checkout line at the Grand Canyon bookstore, I asked Karen if she wanted me to buy her one. I suggested to her that she start collecting park stamps with me on that trip. She gave me her best annoyed to have to answer such a stupid question look and said, "No thanks, I'm a grown-up." For the last 4 years, I've endured her rolling of eyes whenever I would hunt for the stamp at a national park. All the while, I was accumulating an impressive collection. Then it happened, as I knew it would someday. It was earlier this year, and we were packing for a trip to Tucson. Karen said to me, "Don't forget our national park's passport." I paused for effect, then replied, "Our passport?" Pause again. "Sweetie, we don't have a passport. I have a passport." She tried to get me to acknowledge that it was now our passport, even using her, "Everything we have belongs to both of us because we're companions for life and so much in love, yada yada yada," line. Shameless. I didn't give in. On that trip, she bought her very own passport at Saguaro National Park. She carries it with her everywhere, and if anyone asks, will show it with pride. Now she wishes she had it all those times we visited national parks before. I guess I was right. At least she has one now, with fewer stamps than me. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject, Number 1, North Cascades National Park. Date, June 6, 2010. Dear Bob and Sue, I'm writing you from the ferry boat on our way out of Stehekin. Why were we in Stehekin instead of visiting our first national park? Good question. It is impossible to drive to North Cascades National Park. I don't mean difficult, I mean impossible. Rather, I should say nearly impossible. Looking at a map, there is no reasonably accessible road into the park. You can hike into the park, but even then it is confusing to tell when you are within the park boundaries. There's a north and a south unit of North Cascades NP, and Ross Lake National Recreation Area divides the two units. Highway 20, the only road that runs east-west over the mountains, is in Ross Lake National Recreation Area, not the national park. The visitor centers, the park signs, none of these are in the national park. No lodging, no restaurants. In fact, of the top 12 things to do in North Cascades NP listed on TripAdvisor, 11 are not in the park. To make things even more confusing, there's a third national park unit, Lake Chelan National Recreation Area, which is adjacent and to the south of the other two units. The National Park Service manages all three units as a single park complex. We had no idea how we were going to visit the park, so we talked with several rangers at the visitor center in New Halem, not in the park, about this dilemma. They seemed defensive. They must get this question a lot. Their consistent response was, "You are in the park, it's a park complex, and North Cascades National Park is part of the complex." Sorry, maybe it's my OC with a lowercase d talking, but you're either in the park or you're not, and the map says not. It's a shame that it's so inaccessible, because North Cascades National Park is remarkable. Remote mountains, deep valleys, and more than 300 glaciers. But since we'd always wanted to stay at the lodge in Stehekin, in Lake Chelan, NRA, we decided to see if we could hike or bike into the park from there. That's why we were in Stehekin this weekend. Three of the kids went with us, Rachel, Justin, and Matthew. Emily is home studying for finals, so she says. We're glad the kids joined us on our first park trip, but just Karen and I will be going to the other 57. Thursday night, we drove from Issaquah, Issaquah, Washington is 15 miles east of Seattle, to Chelan, where we spent the night. At 8:30 a.m. on Friday, we took the 2.5-hour Lady of the Lake ferry from Chelan to Stehekin. The only way to get to Stehekin is by boat, float plane, horse, or by hiking in. There's a 23-mile road in the Stehekin Valley that is mostly gravel. Locals can arrange to have their vehicles put on a barge that runs every few weeks if they need them brought from or taken to Chelan. This is what I meant when I said there is no reasonably accessible road into the park. As we traveled up the lake, The surrounding hills gradually increased in elevation. Near Chelan, the hills are low and gently rolling. In the summer, they're the color of straw, except for the neatly spaced lines of green made by the irrigated orchards and vineyards. At Stehekin, the peaks are more than 7,000 feet and rise nearly vertically out of the 1,486-foot-deep lake. By the time the boat docked, we felt we were in a different world than the one we came from only a few hours before. We had reservations at Stehekin Landing Resort, which sits right on the water by the ferry dock. There was time to kill before we could check into our cabin, so we walked the mile and a half to the Valley Bakery for lunch. Stehekin has fewer than 100 year-round residents. It's not a crowded place, but while we were walking, four different people in pickup trucks stopped and asked if we wanted a ride. Normally, we wouldn't consider taking a ride from a stranger, but here it's what people do. The residents all know one another and treat visitors like neighbors. It's an exceptionally safe place. We declined the offers, not out of concern, but because we needed to stretch our legs after the long boat ride. Lunch at the bakery was fantastic. Chili, huge deli sandwiches, and fresh-baked cookies. Afterward, we walked back and checked into our cabin. It didn't have air conditioning, TV, internet, or cell phone service, but it had electricity, hot water, a coffee maker, and a magnificent view of the lake. Later that afternoon, Karen and I hiked a few miles of the lakeshore trail. It was beautiful, but Karen walked with her head down the whole way, scanning for snakes and listening for rattles. Every time my foot hit a rock, she'd jump 3 feet in the air. Before the hike, we spoke with a ranger at the Golden West Visitor Center. We asked for hiking suggestions, and she recommended this hike. Her only warning, watch out for rattlesnakes sleeping in the sun on the trail. She went on to tell us, if they bite you, they probably won't use their venom. They can sense you're too big to eat by the vibrations you make when you walk, so they won't waste their venom on you. This didn't comfort me. It was like someone telling me that they're going to shoot me in the calf with a nail gun, but don't worry, the nails are clean. Karen wasn't comforted either. She wanted to see the ranger's diploma from snake school. Whenever we hike in an area with rattlesnakes, Karen has a scenario running through her head where a rattlesnake strikes from out of nowhere and sinks its fangs into her leg. I make an incision with my pocket knife just above the bite, suck out the venom before it reaches her heart, and save her life. What she fails to realize is by the time I found my pocket knife, sharpened it with my honing stone, and sterilized both it and the bite area with my travel-size alcohol wipes, the venom would have done its damage. Fortunately, we had the trail to ourselves. No snakes and few people. Yesterday, Saturday, Karen and I got out of bed about 7 a.m. We knew we had several hours to ourselves before there would be any sign of life from the other three. It was a beautiful morning, so we walked along the valley road. We could smell the bakery before we could see it. We enjoyed a relaxed breakfast of coffee and a shared cinnamon roll the size of a football. At mid-morning, the five of us were at the bike rental stand across the road from the resort. Our plan was to ride along the valley road toward the park boundary. I asked the woman renting us the bikes if she had locks for us to use. She laughed and said, "We don't need locks here. No one's going to take your bike, and if they do, they'll bring it back." Our first stop along the valley road was the old Stehekin one-room schoolhouse. It was built in 1921 and used until the community built the new school in 1988. A short distance from the schoolhouse is Rainbow Falls, where we ate lunch at a Paul Bunyan-sized picnic table within mist range of the 312-foot falls. After lunch, we left our bikes in the grass alongside the valley road across from the falls and walked to the 50-acre historic Buckner Orchard. The ranger at the visitor center made a point of telling us that we own Buckner Orchard, since it's part of the park system. So we thought the least we could do is check it out and see how our orchard was doing. From the valley road a half mile away, a hand-dug irrigation ditch diverted water into the orchard from Boulder Creek just below Rainbow Falls. Water ran swiftly through the 100-year-old ditch as if the Buckners dug it only a few years ago. Our day of biking in the valley was perfect, sunny and temperatures in the 70s. It was like riding a bike through a postcard. Just one problem. We didn't make it to the North Cascades National Park border. After all our side trips, we didn't have the energy to bike the remaining miles to the boundary. We also weren't sure exactly where the boundary was. I don't think we can count this as an official park visit, despite the ranger's assurances that it's all one big happy park complex. This morning, Sunday, we woke up to the sound of rain on the metal roof of our cabin. Fortunately, we hadn't planned on doing much today except taking the ferry back to Chelan and driving home. Our butts were sore from yesterday's bike ride, and the rain was making it hard to get out of bed to pack for home. Sitting inside the Lady of the Lake ferry on our trip back to Chelan, there hasn't been much conversation. I've been doing my best to try and stay awake, but the rain and the sound of the boat's engine are making me sleepy. After a long silence, Karen said, "Justin, I've been meaning to tell you about an article I read this week about the dangers of using a laptop. Researchers think the men who use a laptop while it's resting on their lap can damage their sperm. The laptop can cook their testicles. You don't use a laptop while it's on your lap, do you?" Justin looked terrified, so I jumped in to rescue him. "Karen, first, please don't use the phrase, 'cook your testicles,' ever again. Second, Justin doesn't want to talk about his testicles or his sperm with his mother-in-law."
"I'm serious," she continued. "It can cook his testicles. We want to have grandchildren someday."
I put an end to the testicle discussion, but Justin seems to have disappeared. So our very first park trip was a false start. It was a great visit to a beautiful national recreation area, but we still have 58 national parks to go. I'm happy the kids came with us, but I think they've had enough of us for a while. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject: It's Blinking. Date: June 10, 2010. Dear Bob and Sue, today we hiked into North Cascades National Park, so we could claim that we've officially visited the park. After studying the park map, we found a trail off Highway 20 where we could hike a few miles to the park boundary. We never saw a sign indicating that we had entered the national park, but we're trusting the map and crossing this one off the list. On our way to the trailhead, we stopped to take our picture in front of the park sign in Cedro Woolley, the park headquarters. We've added "taking our picture in front of the park sign" to the list of things we plan on doing in every park. We parked close to the sign so I could balance my digital camera on the hood of the car. I set the timer for 10 seconds, giving me enough time to get in position for the picture. There's a light on the front of the camera that starts blinking once the timer is set. When I pressed the button to start the timer, Karen yelled, "It's blinking!" She scared the shit out of me. I thought someone threw a hand grenade at us. She says this every time we take a picture with a timer, even after I've explained that I know when it is blinking because I'm the one pushing the button that's making it blink, she still yells, "It's blinking." The picture came out slanted because of the slope of the car's hood. I tried setting the camera on the ground. The perspective from down there made us look like giants in the picture. I found a box of saltines in the car and put the camera on the box. This was a slight improvement. At first, we were embarrassed about posing for our picture in front of the park sign. We waited until no one was around, but after a few takes we stopped caring. People in passing cars would honk and shout at us, usually compliments such as, "Nice cracker box." It took many times to get the picture just right. Karen didn't know what to do with her hands. At first, she put them in front of her about waist high, limp at the wrist. I called this her squirrel pose. She insisted she was not holding her hands like a squirrel until I showed her the picture. We tried again. I ran back from the camera after setting the timer and said in a soft voice, "No squirrel," just before the flash went off. Drawing attention to her squirrel pose made it harder for her not to hold her hands that way. On the second picture, she had one hand in squirrel position. Half squirrel. On the third picture, she put her hands straight down at her sides as if she was jumping off a diving board. I called this the high dive. Naming the poses made matters worse. After each take, I would go back to the camera, and Karen would stay in position next to the sign. While I checked the picture, Karen would yell, "Is it okay?" and I would yell back, "Full squirrel again," or "High dive," reset the camera and run back. Eventually, we were laughing so hard that the picture came out perfect. Your friend, Matt.
From Karen Smith. Subject, number 2, Olympic National Park. Date, June 23, 2010. Dear Bob and Sue, I realized as we left the visitor center in Port Angeles that I had forgotten to bring my raincoat on our visit to the rainforest. There was no way I'd make it through the trip without needing one, but I didn't want to tell Matt. I knew he would ask me if a raincoat was on my list of things to bring. I don't ever make a list of things to bring, but maybe I should. I can't let Matt see my list, though, after laughing at his. We'll just keep this between us. We drove the 17-mile Hurricane Ridge Road, climbing steeply in elevation, to the Hurricane Ridge Visitor Center. There we stamped our passports and took pictures of the amazing views of Olympic National Park and beyond. The road to the Hurricane Hill trailhead was free of snow, so we headed over there and hiked the easy 3-mile round-trip trail. About a mile into the hike, we came across a scraggly old marmot. By the look of his fur, he'd seen one too many winters in the Olympic Mountains. Matt was very excited about this rare wildlife sighting until, farther up the trail, we came across many more. The trail was thick with marmots. At first, Matt kept his distance. He wasn't sure if they were biters, but after seeing other hikers casually walk past them, he became more comfortable. Soon he was right in their faces taking pictures. They didn't move. These marmots were accustomed to hikers and cameras. Seeing so many of them close to the trail creeped me out. They're like giant squirrels. I never made eye contact with them, but I could still feel their beady little eyes following me. When we were finished hiking, and Matt was done taking pictures of people pushing strollers up Hurricane Hill, we drove to Lake Crescent Lodge, where several weeks ago we reserved one of the Singer Tavern cottages along the lake. We were staying there for 2 nights. On our way to check in at the main lodge, we were walking past the cottages when Matt pointed out that one of them was in an odd spot. It didn't face the lake. It was sitting at a 45-degree angle, facing the other cottages. Matt made comments about the poor suckers who end up with that cottage. Guess who the poor suckers were today? An hour after checking in, it was still eating at him that we got the dud cabin. When he couldn't stand it any longer, we went to the lodge, and Matt asked the manager if we could move to another cottage. I went over to sit by the fireplace, acting like we weren't together, but I could still hear their conversation. The manager told Matt that all the other cottages were taken. He tried to smooth it over by saying we were lucky because our cottage was one of the most requested cottages at the lodge. When I heard that, I thought, uh-oh. Matt has a low tolerance for bullshit, as if you didn't already know. He couldn't let that slide. So let me get this straight. What you're telling me is that when people call to reserve a cottage, they say, I want the cottage that doesn't face the lake. I don't want any of the other cottages, the ones with a lake view. I want the cottage without the lake view. Is this what you're telling me? I let Matt go on for a couple of minutes, then went to the front desk and said, I'm sorry to interrupt, but is it okay if we take our beers outside to the lawn by the lake? Matt knew my interruption was code for, stop being an asshole. You're only going to piss off the manager. We relaxed in Adirondack chairs at the edge of the lake with a beer. Several beers. It was lovely and tranquil. We may have napped. Eventually, we dragged our cooler into the lobby bar area and found comfortable chairs close to the fireplace. We discovered on a trip to Crater Lake Lodge last year that you're allowed to bring your own food and beverages into the lobbies of National Park Lodges, even if you're not staying there. When it was time for dinner, we decided to stay put and eat in the bar area instead of the dining room. We ordered hamburgers, and after waiting for about half an hour, we saw a kitchen worker bring out our hamburgers and leave them at the end of the bar. From across the room, we watched our hamburgers sit at the end of the bar. About 5 minutes later, we saw the bartender look at our hamburgers, say something to our waitress, and shrug his shoulders. We then watched the bartender and waitress eat our hamburgers. I gave Matt a look with a raised eyebrow, as if to say, this is what happens when you piss them off. It took another half an hour and several confused conversations with our waitress to get new hamburgers. We kept reminding ourselves that staying in the National Park Lodges is about the park experience and not the food or the service. The lodge was crowded with people returning from their day of activities in the park. They milled about while waiting for tables to open in the dining room. We could see them eyeing us, wondering how we got the comfortable chairs next to the fire and if we were leaving any time soon. There was no way we were giving up our prime real estate. We sat there and read for a couple of hours. The front doors of the lodge were open, and a small red squirrel kept running into the great room. His little toenails made a skidding, scratching sound as he raced from place to place. I couldn't stand it, so I read with my feet on top of the cooler. Close by, two couples sat on couches while they waited for their table. They were talking about all the parks they had been to, national parks and others. Their list was impressive. It made me realize we're novices, this being the second park of our trip. There are so many incredible parks that we haven't seen yet. One of the men said, I don't know what it is, but when I see those brown park signs, my heart beats a little faster. Matt and I looked at each other. That's exactly how we feel. This morning, we drank our coffee while gazing out the window of our cottage at the reflection of the lake in the windows of the other cottages. We were up and out early. Olympic National Park has three completely different ecosystems, mountains, rainforest, and ocean beach, and our plan was to see parts of each on this trip. The drive from Lake Crescent to the Ho Rainforest Visitor Center took nearly 2 hours. We hiked the Hall of Mosses Loop, and then several miles of the Ho River Trail. Years ago, we hiked in the Quinault Rainforest at the southern end of the park. I love rainforests. The draping, dripping moss on the giant western hemlocks and Douglas firs makes them look like an enchanted forest straight out of a storybook. We didn't bring lunch with us, so we backtracked to the town of Forks and ate at Sully's Drive-In. Sully's is an old dairy-free-style hamburger place. The area in front of the walk-up order window wasn't closed. It looked like it had originally been open to the outside. There was a weird mix of customers having lunch. Everyone in their own way looked out of place. Loggers in their canvas overalls, three college students with laptops and University of Washington t-shirts, their cars overflowing with camping equipment, several pairs of goth-looking tourists, and Matt and I in our hiking clothes. In Forks, we saw several tour buses. These buses were not taking people into Olympic National Park. They were touring the town. Since you have a teenager, you probably know that the Twilight vampire books and movies are set in Forks. It seems odd that people would pay money to tour places where fictional characters hang out. It's all made up. They didn't even film the movies in Forks. After lunch, we headed to the Pacific Coast. Much of the Pacific coastline on the Olympic Peninsula is part of the park. We drove to a parking lot adjacent to Rialto Beach and walked a mile or two along the beach to the hole in the wall, a sea-carved arch. The coastline is gorgeous, wild and rugged. It was windy, and the spray off the high waves made us damp. There were interesting pieces of driftwood everywhere, even wood that might have been construction debris, small lengths of 2x4, had been rounded smooth as if they'd spent a month in a giant rock tumbler. I picked up a piece of driftwood that looked like a dinosaur with a long neck and was planning to take it home with me until Matt said it looked like a giant penis. Before I could disagree with him, he held out his camera and showed me the picture of me holding it tightly by the neck with a stupid grin on my face. I immediately dropped it on the beach. It's just as well. You're not supposed to remove anything from a national park anyway. Right now, we're back in the Lake Crescent Lodge bar again, having a beer and wishing you were here. We just ordered hamburgers. It looks like a different bartender tonight. Hopefully, he's already eaten dinner. Your friend, Karen.
From Matt Smith. Subject, number 3. Mount Rainier National Park. Date, June 30th, 2010. Dear Bob and Sue, I learned during our visit to Mount Rainier National Park that it's against the law to impersonate a national park ranger. Last night we stayed at Paradise Inn, inside the park on the south side of the mountain. Before leaving the lodge this morning, I asked a park ranger how one would go about getting an official park ranger uniform. We thought it would be a nice birthday gift for you, Bob. I can see you now in those dark green wool trousers, a straw hat with its pine cone embossed leather band, and a bear spray holster loaded and ready. You could wear the uniform in your backyard and practice for when you retire and become a park ranger. When friends come over, you could rope off rooms in your house and give make-believe tours as if it was Harry Truman's house. Or you could wear it on the weekends when you go to Home Depot to get a bag of nails, or whatever it is you get there. The ranger seemed concerned that I was trying to get an official uniform. She said something about it being a federal offense to impersonate a park ranger. I can't imagine this is a big problem for the National Park Service, fake rangers leading unauthorized interpretive hikes. Regardless, keep this in mind if you're planning on going out in public in the ranger uniform I'm going to find for you. I hadn't gotten off to a good start with this ranger. I told her about our plan to visit all 58 national parks. She said, "You know there are more than 58 national parks, don't you?" I acknowledged that there were 300-plus park units, but told her that we decided to go to only 58 that were named National Park. She didn't seem too happy that we were placing a higher priority on some of the park units than others. She was a bit severe. She then asked, How many parks have you been to so far? When I told her that Mount Rainier was our third, she smiled and said, Good luck. On a clear day, we can see Mount Rainier from Issaquah. For years, I've thought about climbing it, but Karen discouraged me. She thinks it's dangerous. She also didn't want to raise three kids by herself. I can't blame her. Over the last 30 years, there have been an average of 2 deaths per year of people climbing Mount Rainier. An unfortunate number, but a small percentage of those who try. In 1966, the number of climbers attempting the summit was 2,000. By 1994, the number had grown to 10,000. It stayed close to that level ever since. During the 2009 climbing season, October 2008 through September 2009, 10,616 climbers took a shot at it. About half succeeded in reaching the summit. By far the most popular routes to the summit start at the Henry M. Jackson Memorial Visitor Center parking lot, adjacent to Paradise Inn. Most climbers hike from the visitor center to Camp Muir, about a 5,000-foot vertical climb, spend the night, and start an early morning push to the summit, which is another 4,000 vertical feet. Most climbers, whether they are successful at summiting or not, make it down without injury or need for rescue or assistance, because almost half use one of the 3 professional guide companies licensed by the Park Service. Last year, there were 18 climbing-related search and rescue incidents in the park. Climbers breaking bones, ankles, legs, ribs, pelvis. One climber was hit in the face with a rock and lost consciousness. Several suffered acute mountain sickness, headache, nausea, dizziness, and one incident involved a ranger who fell 30 feet into a crevasse after accidentally skiing into it. He was lucky to have survived. Karen and I didn't attempt to climb Mount Rainier on this trip. We settled for hiking in the forests in the lower regions of the park. With all the attention on the summit, the trails through the old-growth forests are nearly deserted. The Park Service issues more permits for climbing the summit than for overnight backpacking in the entire rest of the park. That's quite amazing, since the park is 368 square miles. Yesterday, when we got here, we entered through the Stevens Canyon entrance in the southeast corner of the park. The trailhead for the Grove of the Patriarchs Trail is just inside the park. The grove consists of western hemlock, Douglas fir, and western red cedar trees. Some are more than 1,000 years old. We hiked the short loop to the Patriarchs and then continued hiking several miles north along the Ohanapakosh River. A couple of miles into the hike, we met park workers who were building bridges using blown-down trees. They were improving the trail enough to get tools and stock to a river crossing farther north, where they needed to prepare footings for a steel-span bridge being delivered by helicopter later this summer. It looked like a fun job. Chainsaws, hard hats, large trees attached to steel cables being winched into place. I could easily imagine them being a CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps, crew from the 1930s. The lead ranger said the CCC built some of the bridges they were replacing. He told us of a bridge farther up the trail that the CCC built in the 1930s that's still in excellent shape. The original squarehead nails they used on the planks, now smooth from the better part of a century of hiking boots passing over them, are still visible. After leaving the bridge builders, we hiked to the river crossing, where they told us the steel-span bridge was to go. The existing bridge was a single log stretching 30 feet across the Ohanapakosh River at a point where the river drops about 100 feet. The falls were beautiful, but I was nervous walking across the log. One misplaced step would have ended our park's trip. I videotaped Karen as she walked slowly across the log, looking down and carefully putting one foot in front of the other. She accused me of doing this, so if she fell, I'd have proof I didn't push her. I was deeply offended. After our hike, we drove to Paradise Inn. The inn, at 5,400 feet elevation, opened in 1917. There have been several attempts over the years to make Paradise a recreation destination. They built a golf course and tow rope for skiing, but those are gone now. They weren't economically sustainable. Today, the main activity is hiking and climbing. Paradise Inn has been remodeled several times. The most recent project was a 2-year renovation from mid-2006 to mid-2008, when the inn was reinforced to withstand a major earthquake. Mount Rainier is an active volcano, and in an average month there are several small earthquakes on the mountain. There are seismic sensors on the mountain, and scientists believe that if, or when, it erupts, there will be enough warning to evacuate visitors from the park safely. But you never know. Even though the last major eruption was in the mid-19th century, Mount Rainier is one of the most dangerous volcanoes in the world because of its proximity to the Seattle-Tacoma metropolitan area. If Mount Rainier blows in the direction of our house, well, let's just say the park would be visiting us in a hurry. We'd wanted to stay at Paradise Inn since it reopened in 2008. Our parks trip was a good excuse to do it. Last night we sat in the great room for hours, reading and writing postcards. Karen is sending a postcard to each of our kids from every national park we visit. After 58 parks, they will each have a complete set of postcards. Wow! What 20-something-year-old wouldn't want a postcard from all 58 national parks? This morning there was still 5 feet of snow next to the road leading away from the inn. The snowpack is 200% of normal for this time of the year. Driving down the mountain, there was a mile-long section of the road where we saw several marmots. They were odd-looking, as if they were made from marmots' spare parts. Their heads were black, their nose and midsection blonde, and the back third of their bodies light brown. They were hoary marmots, which are different from the Olympic marmots we saw in Olympic National Park. Marmots prefer a very narrow band of elevation. That's why we saw so many in one place on our hike in Olympic, and why we saw so many in one place along the road this morning. Before heading home, we hiked several miles of the Wonderland Trail, a 93-mile path that circles Mount Rainier. About 250 people each year hike the entire trail, which takes an average of 14 days to complete. The Park Service requires a permit to hike the entire trail. They want to keep track of backcountry hikers and to ensure the backcountry campsites aren't overcrowded. In November 2006, a storm caused flooding that destroyed most of the trail's log bridge creek crossings. It was August 2007 before the trail reopened. Ironically, people who have hiked the Wonderland Trail say that even though the trail circles the mountain is rarely visible from the trail. The section we hiked was relatively easy. The elevation gains were small, and for most of the way the trail followed Stevens Creek through a valley south of the main park road. We're lucky that three of the national parks are a short drive from our house. We've made a good start without leaving Washington. But the trips close to home are over now. Next week we start traveling farther. We'll be visiting Cuyahoga Valley National Park in Ohio. Your friend, Matt. Mount Rainier National Park is a 2-hour drive southeast of Seattle, Washington. It was made the fifth national park in 1899 to preserve the wilderness around the volcano, the old-growth forests, and the subalpine wildflower meadows. The centerpiece of the park is the massive 14,410-foot volcanic peak of Mount Rainier. Its year-round glacier-covered peak is nature's lighthouse for the entire Pacific Northwest. It has the highest topographic prominence of any mountain in the lower 48 states. This means it looks taller than mountains its same size, because the land that surrounds it is so much lower in elevation. Sea level is only 50 miles away.
From Karen Smith. Subject, number 4, Cuyahoga Valley National Park. Date, July 6, 2010. Dear Bob and Sue, before planning our park trips, we'd never heard of Cuyahoga Valley National Park. Just south of Cleveland, it includes 33,000 acres along 22 miles of the Cuyahoga River. The river is the most famous part of the park for being polluted. So polluted, it caught fire at least 13 times between 1868 and 1969. But the health of the river is improving, and while the National Park Service hasn't prohibited recreational activities in the river, they seriously discourage them. The park newsletter warns that the river is contaminated with pathogens such as E. coli. Signs are posted that say, no swimming, no wading, no boating. We didn't need signs to keep us away. They had us at E. coli. We arrived at the park yesterday just after noon. It was warm and humid, even for July. Our first stop was the Canal Visitor Center in the north end of the park, where we stamped our passports and looked around the museum. Anxious to see the park, we drove south to Hunt Farm Visitor Center, stopping at the two other visitor centers along the way. Immediately, we noticed the park didn't have the "You've entered a sacred, pristine place" feeling that we get in the other national parks. It was a hodgepodge of forest, houses, small businesses, and highways crisscrossing overhead. The road we drove through the park, Canal Road, unexpectedly changed names, took us out of the park, and changed names again. There were so many roads in and out of the park that we were never sure when we were in the park and when we weren't. It felt like a typical rural area in the Midwest rather than a national park. We knew, before we got here, that Cuyahoga Valley National Park was different from the other national parks. It didn't become a national park to protect a rare or unusual landscape or other natural resource. It became a national park because the local citizens wanted it to be a national park. By the 1960s, the valley was in danger of becoming an unbroken chain of urban development from Cleveland to Akron. Local leaders decided it needed the protection that a National Park Service site is assured. The Park Service and Department of the Interior resisted, not wanting to divert funds from the Western Crown Jewel parks like Yellowstone and Yosemite. In 1973, the National Park Service director declared, "I will tell you one thing. The Cuyahoga Valley will be a park over my dead body." The following year, President Ford, under pressure from environmental groups, reluctantly signed the bill that established Cuyahoga Valley National Recreation Area. Over the following 34 years, more than $200 million was spent to purchase land for the park, restore nearly 100 historic structures, and establish activities for visitors. Eventually, supporters called for full national park status, and they got it. In 2000, the name was changed to Cuyahoga Valley National Park. In a nutshell, locals got the federal government to purchase and restore their polluted landscape, manage these outdoor spaces, and provide recreation and cultural activities for the millions of people living just outside its borders.